Hey, it's Steve Cochran. Welcome, and thanks for listening to another edition of Live from My Office, the podcast. Look, wherever, whenever, however you listen, know that I thank you. Everywhere podcasts are, Apple, Spotify, CochranShow.com, or anything else you pick us up on. Your microwave, your fancy refrigerator. Look, subscribe, follow, rate and comment on Live from My Office. Subscribe and follow so you never miss an episode. Rate and comment on it because, well, we use that information for only good and never evil, and we appreciate it. We're sponsored, of course, by Team Hochberg, 855-56-DAVID or 56david.com. All he wants to do is save you money. 855-56-DAVID or 56david.com. Obviously, the news has been inundated with COVID, the election, and we miss a lot of news. And normally I'd give you three things when I go down this road, but I just have one story for you that I think you need to hear coming up. Now today, look, I'm not as young as I used to be, as everyone in my life reminds me. And I get another reminder from my knees. I need new knees. And you might be thinking, well, swing by Costco. They sell everything in bulk. But the deal is my orthopedist, one of the best, Dr. Charles Lupo, is going to join us, and he's going to talk about full replacement knee surgery on me, because when we talk about stuff like this, it might help you or your parents or your grandparents. It's just information that I think you may find interesting and stuff that may spur you to take better care of yourself as well. And Dr. Kevin Most on this All Health episode has a COVID update. Yeah, it's bad. It's really bad. But as always, you need to hear what Dr. Kevin Most has to say. But first, new Kim is worth her tiny weight in gold and then some. A wealthy Chinese pigeon racing fan, that's not a typo, that's an actual sentence, put down a record price of 1.6 million euros. That's almost $2 million for one single Belgian bred bird for pigeon racing. This is the thing that I didn't quite understand. This is a really big deal in certain parts of the world. There's a crazy last half hour of the bidding last Sunday, and a 2-week auction came to a close at the Pippa Pigeon Center, and there were two competing Chinese bidders. They were operating under anonymous pseudonyms. Well, of course, they were calling themselves Super Duper and Hitman. Hitman drove the price of the pigeon up $325,000. That's how they beat the record. The record that Belgian-bred Armando the pigeon fetched last year, but well behind the number gained by New Kim. 1.6 million euros, $1.9 million for a single bird. So I'm not going to leave you hanging. I know you have questions. Pigeon racing? Yeah, pigeon racing. Pigeon racing might be as much as 5,000 years old. And there are historians and certain records that say it was Genghis Khan's favorite sport. And you know what a laugh riot Genghis Khan was. And you probably thought, pigeon racing? I always thought he was more of a bowler. Now, carrier pigeons are the first thing that comes to mind if you think of pigeons doing something other than flying around and pooping on your car. 1,000-mile flights, regular ways for these pigeons to do their thing. They have to be highly trained. They can have a 3 to 10 year career. They can fly as fast as 90 miles an hour. So as always, Live from My Office is educational and entertaining and pigeon preferred. So good luck to New Kim and to all of the illegal wagering going on in the pigeon market. I also saw something else about this, which was disturbing on a different level. Apparently, there's been in horse racing and certainly in track and field and other sports, there's a problem with illegal doping in pigeon racing. And these pigeons are being fed certain drugs that might make them fly longer or fly faster. And they're at great risk, by the way. Falcons in particular like to have a nice pigeon snack, lunch, or dinner. So sometimes these very expensive birds don't make it back. Now, the race itself is you take your pigeon, you drive him or however you want to get him there out to a certain distance where the race will start. And it's always miles and miles and miles and miles. It could be 60 miles, could be 600 miles. and then all the pigeons in the race are released at the same time. When the pigeons get back to their loft, or one loft, which is one type of pigeon racing, their time is checked and the fastest time wins. And people bet a lot of money on this, a lot of money. But this doping of the birds, it includes pain relieving medicine, because, you know, you're flying and you're having falcons chase you. But also, in some cases, the birds' blood samples were taken and they had cocaine in their blood. Now, I can't imagine how tiny that spoon was, or where that party occurred, but that's not a good thing. And for all the ethics that we would assume there are in pigeon racing, I hope they take a good hard look at themselves. All right, stick around. Hear about my new knees. But first, it's Dr. Kevin Most on COVID. Yep, and it's important stuff. Hear it here next on Live from My Office. Live from My Office, sponsored by David Hochberg and Team Hochberg. What is Team Hochberg? Well, powered by Homeside Financial. Been doing loans since 2000, licensed to provide mortgage lending services across this great country of ours. Team Hochberg really makes the process simple. All you have to do is grab a couple of pieces of your own paperwork, stuff that you should have in a particular place anyway, and don't make him call you 11 or 12 times to get that. Just do your part. They'll roll with it, and they're going to be able to save you a whole bunch of money. They have dedicated in-house support staff that, of course, includes underwriters and closing folks. And you're not going to get some closing scam when you work with David Hochberg and Team Hochberg. It's not some teaser thing that comes in. If he says he's going to help you with closing costs, he's going to help you with closing costs. He's going to get you the lowest possible number, and you're going to feel better about it because you're going to get a great rate and you're going to deal with somebody who's going to be just as thrilled as you are that you got that great rate, because that's why he goes to work. He goes to work because he's got plenty. Let me tell you something. He's got plenty of money. He goes to work so he can now be the guy to help you get over the hump. There's a million scenarios of things that have happened and he knows all of them. So here's the deal. Don't be embarrassed. There's nothing you can tell him that he hasn't heard already. It's David Hochberg and Team Hochberg, 855-56-DAVID or 56David.com. This is Live from My Office, and of course, we need an update from Dr. Kevin Most. I wish we could tell you the news is better. In fact, it sounds like, Doc, it's a little bit worse.
Yeah, yep, it is. It's we certainly haven't peaked yet, which is a concern, and we don't know when that peak is going to be. So, you know, the uplifting news last week of the vaccine has certainly been offset by the continued increases in not only number of cases, but percentage positive rates as well as hospitalizations.
So, beds are the key issue here. Staff is the key issue here. The number of sick people have to have a place to go if they need to be hospitalized, and you have to have staff that can take care of them. Where are we with that?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest concern is staffing. You know, we start to see these increases in cases, and everyone has to understand that we're able to treat them a little bit more effectively now. So their length of stay has gone from the average length of stay of 8 days down to 4 days, with obviously some outliers. But really, our biggest thing right now is making sure we have a nursing team to put on the field. They have to deal with their own exposures in the community and their homes, as well as we're asking them to work extra shifts because we need extra nurses when we have as many COVID positive patients as we have.
So where are the nurses coming from at your hospital and other hospitals when you have this need? Because it's a finite number, right? It's not like you can just dial them up at any time.
Correct. The vast majority of them are ours stepping up and doing additional shifts. We are looking at some nurses coming out of office-based practices to come back into the hospital setting to help out there. And then we are seeing some what we call agency nurses, essentially locum workers, that they'll go across the country and work. However, everyone in the world is looking for them, so they're getting to be not only very rare, but very expensive. So it's really a lot of our own staff stepping up at this time and really being, I mean, I hate to use the word heroes, it's been overused, but they really have stepped up and are champions here.
You know, you told me a story or something that I suppose was in the news, but I frankly had missed it, and that is a real illustration of how bad it is. Was it North Dakota or South Dakota where COVID positive nurses are being forced to work because they don't have anybody else?
Yeah. Yeah. In South Dakota, you know, they're out of nurses, and I'm not sure they're forcing them, but they're at least allowing the nurses who are COVID positive, but asymptomatic, to continue to come in and work. You know, they're wearing the appropriate PPE. They're obviously distancing themselves from other individuals, and they're taking care of COVID patients. So it's hard to give someone COVID that already has COVID. They're looking at it as, if we don't have them, we won't have anybody. So we'll be as safe as possible, but still using the asymptomatic positive nurses.
Yeah, and by the way, I didn't mean to indicate that you were locking the doors and not letting them leave, but forcing them to work, meaning they needed to be at work because there was simply nobody else to do the care. So, I mean, good for them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it got to a point where some hospitals in South Dakota were airlifting COVID patients, which is unheard of. You know, the vast majority of hospitals can care for COVID patients. So when they're airlifting them, it is 100% due to staffing and beds.
So what happens when you run out of room?
You find more room. It really comes down to the staffing portion of it. So, you know, all of the rooms now are obviously private rooms at most hospitals. Many of them are big enough that you could double them up and go back to double rooms and be as safe as you possibly can in those double rooms. And then we're also finding other areas that weren't rooms, but we're actually making them into hospital beds. So we have the ability to bring in all the monitoring equipment, and there's enough bathrooms and showers close enough that we can use those rooms as well.
So the trend line that, as you listen to this, wherever you are in the country or the world, we live in Illinois. We're outside Chicago. So the trend line in Illinois is bad. Frankly, it's not as bad as it is in some other places, but what do you see, or what are you aware of maybe that will stop this trend from getting worse?
That's the biggest concern, Steve, is that we're not seeing anything that's slowing the trend. Matter of fact, you know, we continue to see the positivity rate increase. And then it just comes down to math. Although the disease is less virulent than it was initially, but it's more contagious. And we're seeing the surge. And like I said, we used to have patients staying, well, the average length of stay of 8 days. We're getting those down to 4 days, which allows you to see twice as many patients. If we were back in the spring where we didn't have remdesivir, we didn't know about dexamethasone, didn't know about putting patients on their stomach and giving them high flow oxygen instead of putting them on ventilators, we would be absolutely crushed right now. So we're holding our own, but you know, we got it down to 8 COVID patients. Oh, what was it? 4.5, 5 weeks ago, 8 COVID patients with none in the intensive care. We were at 105 this morning with 20 in the intensive care.
Those are just not sustainable.
They're not sustainable from a staffing point of view. And the bad thing is, we don't know where this peak is going to end. We've discussed it. You know, at CDH, are we looking at 120, 130, 150? So, you know, we'll make some changes with elective surgeries probably here quickly. We'll start to look at other things that we can potentially move offsite. But for the most part, it's going to be all comes down to math and staffing and the ability for these nurses to continue to step up and do what they've been doing.
I don't understand the disconnect, and I know I'm beating a dead horse here because you and I have talked about this since March, but I don't understand the disconnect with the two simple things that we can do. We can't, you know, develop a vaccine. We can't treat patients ourselves. We're not doctors. We're not research scientists. We're not nurses. But as citizens, we social distance and we wear a mask. That's all we can do. But it does make a huge difference. And I don't want to hear about, oh, the studies are inconclusive and this and that. Marginally helping is more than what we're doing now. And I know one of your big concerns is now we're less than 2 weeks away from Thanksgiving. And that is going to be a major issue.
Definitely. I mean, patients, and when I say patients, I'll just say the general public, have these blinders on. And the blinders are saying 90%, 85%, 92%, whatever percent number you want to use of young, healthy people or people that are in good health don't have an impact with this illness. That is not the issue here. What people have to have to know is that the reason we're trying to bend the curve is to not put the strain on the healthcare system. We know that a lot of people are going to do just fine with this illness. But we know a lot of people are not. And as we, you know, put that big push on the healthcare system, it'll go to a point of breaking. Thanksgiving is a perfect example, as you're talking about. You know, you think about that and think, go back the last four or five Thanksgivings and look around your table and look how many people would be declared to be in a vulnerable population, and then start to do the math and say by Thanksgiving, we'll probably have a positivity rate somewhere between 15 and 20%. That's unbelievable. So if you have 10 people sitting around the table, chances are two of them are going to be asymptomatic positive. And it's not like, you know, we're at a fast food place where you eat and leave. At Thanksgiving, you sit around the table, you spend a lot of time, you don't have a mask on, and you're within feet. And usually it's even tighter than that. You jam as many people as you possibly can to the adults' table so that everyone, you know, has the experience. And this is not the year to do it.
And you and I both know that there are parties that are happening, and it's football season and football watch parties and things that people are, I don't know if it's COVID fatigue or if they just don't believe, but it's a deadly circumstance, and I'm not being hyperbolic here, to blow this stuff off. And as you see these numbers go up every single day, you know, you just want to say, well, what part of this do you not get? Those numbers aren't just magically going up. Those numbers are going up because more people are getting sick, and more people are getting sick because more people are being exposed. How could they be exposed? Because we're not doing what we ought to be doing.
Right. And everyone has to realize that we are looking 2 weeks down the road from the rates today. So in other words, every time it's going up, we know 2 weeks from now we're going to be busier. So really, from the hospital's point of view, we're looking for a plateau or a decrease in the positivity rate. And we're not seeing that. People say, well, you're not seeing it because you're testing more people. And that's not the case. We're not seeing it because more people have this illness. When you see a positivity rate where it is, that's not because we're testing more. If that were the case and we were testing more, the positivity rate would go down. In other words, if only a certain number of people have it, the more you test, the number should go down. In fact, it's the opposite. We're out there and we're missing a lot of people who still have it, who we haven't even tested. So there's many people that think that the positivity rate is not at 13%, but is closer to 25%.
Yeah, it's just math. That's it.
Yep.
And I'm going to put my faith in the scientists and the doctors in the same way I put my faith in whatever experts I have in my life do what they do. And I guess I just would ask people again, because again, I'm beating a dead horse. But if you go to get your car fixed, it's because you don't know how to fix it and you need the mechanic. In the case of this, the experts are the people who are going to try to limit the damage and get us out of this. And the more we pay attention and the sooner we pay attention, the faster we get to the other side of this. We've made this worse for ourselves, but that can stop today if we start behaving the way we should. Yeah, it sucks. Nobody wants to miss Thanksgiving. Nobody wants to do Christmas on FaceTime. But if we want to get to Christmas where we actually have a shot to be together, we got to do this right now, not tomorrow, not next week, right now.
You're spot on. And, you know, I'll just put it in my terms. You know my family very well. You know my mom. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to be the host of Thanksgiving, which I am, where my mom ends up getting COVID and something bad happens. And that's our Thanksgiving memory going forward.
Right.
You know, I would much rather remember, hey, remember how that one Thanksgiving, how we all had to do it on Zoom and we all made fun of each other about how we cooked and we laughed and we still shared what we were thankful for. That's much better than sharing that, boy, I can't believe I had to host a super spreader event and I can't tell you how many people it impacted because they went beyond my own family. So I think it's just time for us to be just right off this year, take a step back and say, you know what, let's make the best of what we have here, but let's try to slow this down. Because the healthcare providers are not going to do well.
There's nothing else we can do but that. Well, you guys continue to try to stop the bleeding, pardon the analogy, but stop the bleeding of these numbers and how this is going until it's not necessary, not needed. I mean, I just hope that 2021 makes us forget 2020 because of all the bad things that happened. But if 2021 is a relief from this year, all this is going to be worth it. And we know we're going to get to the other side of this. We know there's vaccinations that have been sped up to a point that no one even thought was possible. We will get there. But the only thing slowing us down from getting there right now is the behavior of all of us who are able to do more and don't. I don't know how else to put it, Doc.
No, you're right. And we had such promising news with the vaccine last week, and we'll get more promising news, I assure you, between now and Christmas when AstraZeneca comes out with theirs, and Moderna comes out with their results, and Johnson & Johnson comes out. And next thing you know, we're talking about vaccinations instead of illnesses. And I would just say to everybody, please just take a breath. Get some time right now. Take the sacrifices of wearing a mask and doing the distancing. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. And if we get the next phase 3 vaccine come out with as good a results as we got with Pfizer, we're going to be in a great shape. And people have to understand, we have 12 different vaccines in phase 3. So this is not a one-horse game. This is not a Pfizer can't make enough vaccines, so why are we even worried? Are you kidding? We may have 10 companies making vaccines by Easter of next year.
Right.
And that's what we have to look forward to.
It's Dr. Kevin Most, Northwestern Medicine, Central DuPage Hospital. And we thank you for the continued updates on this, because even if it's bad news, we need to tell folks about it. Mask up, social distance, do the right thing. And there's light at the end of the tunnel. Doc, any last words?
No, and you know what? If you know, we have Thanksgiving coming up. We have a lot to be thankful for, even though we may not think that. But I assure you, if you have a nurse that you know, a physician that you know, tell them thanks, and tell them that you're in it for them. And I think not only are we need the morale side of it, because we certainly are going to be beaten up on the physical side of it, but we certainly need those people to remind us that we went into the profession for the right reason.
Yeah. Amen. Well said. It's Dr. Kevin Most. Thank you, my friend.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Live from my office, always sponsored by the great people at Team Hochberg, and specifically David Hochberg. I've known David for a long time. As I've said to you before, if you listen, I am the one that uses David Hochberg, and I mean that in a positive way. I am the one who told my sister to use David Hochberg. She's done it twice now. I am the one that had my daughter use Team Hochberg to buy her first house, and she's in the middle of refining right now. And believe me, in the WGN days, just about everybody in the building asked for help from David Hochberg. Now, what is Team Hochberg? Team Hochberg is a team that he assembled of the best people in the mortgage and money businesses. And these folks are ready to help you. It's simple. You go on the website at 855-56-DAVID. You can get a free rate quote request in right there. Or pick up the phone and call them at 855-563-2843. That's 855-56-DAVID or 56David.com. It's that easy. Go to the website, poke around there a little bit, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Again, I use David Hochberg. I have. I will again. And part of Team Hochberg is a whole collection of experts to help with your money. We all just, let's be honest, we don't know money. We don't know money. He knows money. He knows money. He knows the people who know how to do anything related to making your house more livable, more fun, and really everything you want it to be. I mean, it's not like one of those HGTV shows. He's not going to have a tool belt and a hammer. But he's going to come in and he's going to hammer away. I know I'm better than that at making sure you have the best rate on your mortgage or your refi. He can also bring in his credit enhancement expert. He can talk to the folks that can help you with whatever remodeling you might want to do. He's got everybody. He knows everybody. So make sure you get on it. Team Hochberg, 56 David or 56David.com. 855-56-DAVID or 56David.com. This is live from my office. And, you know, all those years on the radio, and I will always do this, whatever I'm doing, talking about what I might be dealing with or going through maybe can help you. Now, the hair loss thing, well, that ship has sailed. But it turns out I'm in the market for a new knee, and I'm happy to say that one of the finest orthopedic surgeons, one of the finest people in America, Dr. Charles Lupo, Charlie, is on the phone now so we can talk about my knee, and maybe some of this stuff will help you. Good morning, Doc.
Morning, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. Now, we've been on this journey, if you will, for a couple of years now. So, and I think people could probably relate best to where they might be on it as well or where they might be headed. So I am 59 years old. I've got a couple of pre-existing surgical issues, the most important of which is three pulmonary embolisms, a propensity for blood clots, which you get with surgery. So there's some extra layers of this that come in. But let's go back to where you and I met. And the initial treatment for this was Synvisc, or this injection of what you describe it. What is the thing you put in to cushion the knee prior to surgery?
Yeah. So usually when someone first comes in to see us, and we can make it, we're assuming we're going on the diagnosis of arthritis. I am an orthopedic surgeon who my specialty is in hip and knee replacement predominantly, which the number one reason for that across America is kind of your standard wear and tear arthritic disease, whereby the cartilage or the padding tissue that lines the end of the joint, and in your case, Steve, being your knee, you wear that cartilage out. And similar to wearing out the brake pads in your car is maybe a reasonable analogy that people can understand. And when that happens, you start to get what many people describe as bone-on-bone disease, and that's where the pain arises from. And so our first line of treatment is usually non-surgical. Not everybody who presents with arthritis, and most people who initially present with arthritis do not need to jump into a surgical fix for that. So we try a number of non-surgical things, medication, physical therapy, low-impact exercise, and then injections come as a mainstay of treatment for many people. And the injections really come in two flavors. There's your standard kind of cortisone or steroid injection, whereby you try to reduce the inflammatory component of the arthritis. And then there's these alternative injections that you're referring to that come in a number of descriptions, but mainly it's the substance called hyaluronic acid. It is a synthetic material that is made in a laboratory that is supposed to mimic the normal fluid that is made by the cartilage when present to lubricate the joint. And so some people get a couple weeks, other people can get several months worth of relief out of it. It is something to kind of try. It doesn't cure the arthritis, but we did those and have been doing some injections on you for the last 2 years. And they work for a time, and over time their efficacy can kind of wane. And then we start to talk about the other alternatives. But that's what we did for you. We tried those gel injections, many people call them. Some people even call them rooster comb or the chicken shot. You'll hear many names.
Which is funny because they're made from rooster comb, right?
Correct. Some of the building blocks of that substance that your knee makes to lubricate the joint, collagen and other proteins and sugar complexes actually are found in the comb of a rooster, the red kind of spongy tissue that the roosters have, and then they can extract some of that and make it into a lubricating tissue that is the goal is to try to help people with arthritic disease get through daily activities and have a normal functioning life to the best you can when you have arthritis.
So after the HA, the hyaluronic, that acid thing you mentioned, after that we went to cortisone. And in both cases, what you just indicated was true. They work for a period of time, and then eventually they stop working. So does the body just get used to the substance and say, yeah, no more for me? Or why is it that they can work for a period of time and then they stop working in regards to reducing the inflammation?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't know if we have a definitive answer to that. I have some patients who have the same amount of arthritis on the X-ray, radiographically, but the way that arthritis affects them is substantially varied. Some patients have really bad arthritic disease, end-stage bone-on-bone arthritis, and they tolerate their symptoms reasonably well. There are other patients who have more moderate arthritis or even more severe arthritis and really have struggled in their ability to get around on a daily basis, to have a regular and normal quality of life. So even right there, it shows that, the X-rays themselves don't often dictate the amount of disability that people experience. Why in the beginning the injections work better than as time goes on, I don't have a great explanation for. I think some of it may be the body does get used to it over time. That would make sense logically, although I don't know how you prove that scientifically. I also think as time goes on, arthritic disease just becomes more progressive. You lose more cartilage, you get more of a deformity, and your ability to tolerate daily activities becomes more difficult. So I don't know if it's that the injections are becoming less efficacious or that the arthritis is progressing. It's probably a combination of both would be my best guess.
And just a primer on osteoarthritis, pardon me, we'll edit that cough out. But the osteoarthritis, it can spread to other joints, right?
Well, I think people experience it, whether they have a genetic propensity to it, whether it is the environment or their occupation or their level of exercise, their weight. There's many factors that go into arthritis presenting itself in various joints. From our best understanding, unless you have an underlying autoimmune disorder like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or other inflammatory disorders, then yes, in the sense of it can spread, meaning that process can occur in other joints, I would think in more of a traditional sense of spreading, you could consider it that way. When it's wear and tear arthritis, I don't think it's spreading in the way that you have it in your left knee, and now there is a process whereby that is metastasizing, so to use some cancer terminology, or translocating to another joint. I don't think it's a process moving itself to another joint. It's probably just the same mechanical process occurring in other joints because for whatever reason you are susceptible to getting arthritic disease from a number of environmental, genetic, and kind of daily life factors.
All right, well, that makes sense, and it's well put by you. So I can have osteoarthritis in one knee or both knees. And if I get it in my hands or whatever, it's because my body, my metabolism, my makeup, whatever the words would be, is more likely to have that happen. That makes sense. It's common sense, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And we may find out, you know, we're always finding out new things each successive year, and research is always ongoing, that maybe there is a process whereby it somehow translocates and physical, you know, mechanisms are occurring that then do it. But as far as we know from the available evidence, we can't say we can put a direct connection from left knee to right hand and that those two things are invariably connected. Just we can't say that at this point, but certainly in the future we may have a different discussion about that.
So as of right now, I am scheduled to have Dr. Lupo do a right knee replacement in early December. We're recording this on November 15th, well aware of the fact that could be postponed indefinitely because it's an elective surgery and there's a need for what's more important right now, and that is to be able to have beds to take care of the COVID patients. But we're going to press ahead here and at least do the setup for this as if we are going to go through with it. Is it a total knee replacement? Because, you know, when you first hear those words, you think you're going to hack off the knee, top and bottom, and then slap them back together. What is it?
Yeah. So there are knee replacements do come in a few varieties. There is, people will hear about a partial knee replacement, which certainly is done across the country, and a total knee replacement. Oftentimes, it's multifactorial as to who's a candidate for one versus the other. We are doing a total knee replacement on you because the entire knee joint, there's really three components or three sections to the knee, three compartments we call them, and all three compartments, the medial compartment, the lateral compartment, and then underneath the kneecap on you have arthritis throughout. And so to only do a partial knee replacement where you would put a device in to just take care of arthritis in a specific segment of a individual knee joint, you don't qualify because that would leave remaining arthritis in the other segments of the knee that would not be replaced. So there's a time and place for a partial knee replacement, but you're, Steve, are lucky enough to have disease throughout the whole knee.
Good for
me.
So
yes, so you fall into that category, and so you'll get a complete knee replacement whereby we do cut, you know, the ends of the bones off that are arthritic. We shave off that arthritic cartilage, and then we use an implant to cap the ends of the bones. That's kind of a metal implant that gets placed onto the ends of the bones and caps them. And then in the intervening surfaces, so the metal isn't contacting the metal, there is a polyethylene component that gets placed in between them, and that really recreates the cartilage surface or the shock-absorbing padding tissue in the joint. So instead of having that bone-on-bone disease that we identified on your x-rays, that you now have this device recreating the moving surfaces of the joint. At the same time, you have a bit of a deformity of your knee, which many people get with arthritis. You have a bowing deformity of your knee, and in conjunction with replacing the joint, our goal is to realign that knee so that mechanically it's kind of realigned so that you no longer have the bow in the knee that comes with arthritic disease. You have the native anatomic alignment to allow a healthy transference of your weight through that knee joint.
Yeah, and is that what goes to the situation I'm in now where I've got a little bit of the Herman Munster walk, you know, the stiff Frankenstein, the stiff-legged walk, because the flexibility, yes. You know, I'm not pulling a golf ball out of the hole without, some effort, and I'm not crouching down and playing catcher and softball anymore, or baseball. The flexibility just isn't there. So is that the bowing you're talking about?
Partially. So what happens when you get arthritis is not only do you wear the cartilage down, but your body creates these large bone spurs on the periphery of the joint. And those bone spurs take up space. They occupy or tent the tissues in the back of the knee that can prevent your knee from getting all the way straight. They can develop in your case, on the inner portion of the knee and can kind of contract the tissues so that those tissues aren't functioning at their normal, healthy, physiologic length. And when that occurs, you can start to develop either a bow-legged deformity, which some patients get, or if you develop more arthritis on the outside of the knee, you'll see patients come into the office or even people walking down the street with a knock knee deformity. And so either of those need to be corrected at the time of surgery. And when you do correct that, the range of motion can often improve because you decompress that joint space and you allow these tissues to start functioning at their normal working length. You help them kind of regain their flexibility over time. That doesn't happen immediately after surgery. Those tissues need a few weeks or even several months to stretch out. And I think it underlies the point that I try to impress upon you in the office and also to patients I see regularly, is that when it comes to knee replacement and hip replacement, which I do both of, I often tell patients the pain relief and the functionality with the hip replacement tends to come along a little bit quicker. I liken it to flipping on a light switch. When you get your hip replaced, it is very akin to flipping on a light switch where you almost immediately feel a relief of pain. When it comes to knee replacement, it's more like raising a dimmer switch. It takes a few weeks, even the first 2 to 3 months, to try to get your function back, to regain your ability to walk with a normal gait, to get the strength of the supporting muscles around the knee back and in good, healthy working order, and to also get the ligaments that balance and help support the knee back at their working functional length. So it's a bit of a process. Your journey will not end once the surgery is complete.
And
there's a process afterwards.
Yeah, and we'll take that up in part two of this, which you probably don't know.
No doubt.
Probably don't know you agreed to do when we get closer to the surgery or just past it. All right. So part of your job, obviously, is managing patient expectations. So what when somebody is at a point where they need surgery and they're ready to go? Well, actually, let me back it up even further than that. What's the best way for someone to know it's time to get a knee replacement? Is it lifestyle or is it physical or is it both?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that underscores something as I've evolved in my practice and I've treated more patients and seen more people after surgery, it seems like as the surgeon, one of the best things I can do is set reasonable expectations for patients. And so this is a topic I like to speak of because I think sometimes surgeons like to project confidence in what we do, right? You want people to understand that we're going to make you better, but you also have to impart upon patients that in the end, this is a knee out of a box, right? It's metal, it's plastic. Many times it's cemented or grouted into your bone, like the tiles in your bathroom are grouted together. It is not the knee that Steve Cochran had when he was a young buck
right.
At the age of 25, living life, not thinking about your knee. It's a mechanical device. It has some limitations. I really tell people the goal of our surgery is to make you better than you were. Certainly to limit the pain that comes along with progressive arthritis, to stop the down, you know, the ongoing or downward trajectory that people have. You know, you over time, since we've met you, you went from playing however many rounds of golf a year to less than that. You know, your ability to do daily activities and to get your exercise has gone down in the several years I've known you, and that's common for most patients. So what I try to tell people is we want to be able to get you to a level where your pain is certainly much less than when we started. Functionally, you can do more things, stairs, going on long walks, hiking, biking, swimming, you know, taking care of your grandkids, going to your family, the soccer games, and all the things that people like to do when they get into their older years and they've been dreaming about their retirement. They retire, and the next thing you know, their knee goes bad and they can't do all the things that they were hoping to do when retirement came. So I think for most daily activities, people get better with knee replacements. We don't really design knee replacements or encourage people to get back to running marathons and 5Ks. And it's just, it's a mechanical device. It really can't handle a lot of those high level activities. So I think what people need to understand about joint replacement is it's an excellent surgery. Most patients can expect at least a very good to an excellent result, but there are limitations. We have to be reasonable about what we as surgeons can provide for people. Whereas, you know, the body has developed this beautiful, complex knee joint over many, many thousands of years here, and we're trying to recreate that in our 40 or 50 years understanding of knee replacement surgery. So I think managing expectations is big. To go to your other question, I think is important, is how do I know? When do I know that joint replacement is right for me? And usually what I tell people is it's not so much based on your x-rays. We shouldn't have surgeons just coming into the room, looking at an x-ray and saying, well, you need your knee replaced, without actually understanding how does that knee on the x-ray affect this person on a daily basis. If it affects your quality of life, if you can't exercise, if you can't sleep, if you have difficulty doing what we call activities of daily living, getting to and from your job, going up and down stairs, taking care of your lawn and your backyard and things around the house, that's when the time for joint replacement is. It's really based off your symptoms and how much it bothers you, not so much just the fact that you have arthritic disease.
But if you leave it alone for an extended period of time, the damage does get worse, right?
It's seemingly so, yeah. And there, it's a, you kind of got to thread a needle a little bit with patients when it comes to knee replacement, because if you do it when the patient still has a very functional knee, whereby they don't have a lot of restrictions despite having some pain that can be limiting, those patients may not like their knee replacement, even with a little bit of pain, more so than they would like they're still having their own knee in place. When patients kind of get to the point where, so that's one set of people where you don't want to do it too early, and then you're giving them a knee that is more mechanical feeling when they haven't had symptoms for very long and they don't have a lot of restrictions in their life. The converse to that, or the other side of that coin, is that sometimes people can go a little bit too long and then they become very debilitated. They become pain or walker dependent. Their mobility has gone down. They become deconditioned because they're very sedentary. It seems like those patients, and there's some studies to support it, they may have a little harder time getting back to normal and having a real, real outstanding outcome. It seems like the people in the middle who are fairly debilitated by it, they are not terribly deconditioned yet. They're still able to get some exercise in. They have functional deficits, but they're teetering on the ability of to really get around without thinking about their knee a lot or planning around their knee, or paying for activities down the road. If they try to go to their grandson's soccer game and they got to walk three fields and back to the parking lot, and then 3 days later they're still hurting, you know, that person is starting to get in the sweet spot where functionally they're able to still do a lot of daily activities, but if they're starting to become restricted, it seems like those are the people in the sweet spot who do best with replacement surgery.
And obviously this is mostly people my age and older, but you do see this in younger folks as well.
Correct. Yeah, you're at about the age, the average age, or in that range of where people in America are getting their joints replaced. Certainly, younger patients they tend to not have run of the mill arthritis. These are often, you know, when you get patients in their 40s or 50s who need a hip or knee replacement, they've often either had some sort of congenital problem with development of the joint, or they have things like rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune diseases that have been brewing for many years since they were in their young adulthood, and now it's culminating in their 40s or 50s, or someone who has had past trauma, you know, a past fracture or injury to the, you know, we see a lot of injuries to the ACL and the anterior cruciate ligament or the meniscus tissue in the joint, and that could put people at a higher risk of needing a joint replacement surgery at an earlier age. But you're kind of around that average age of where most people in the U.S. are getting their joints replaced, late 50s, early 60s.
Right. So I'm 59. So we'll talk about how important the post-surgery therapy is, the physical therapy, and how you got to do it to get the full benefit of the surgery and to get back to life faster. But realistically, when these surgeries go well, how long do these joints last?
That's a good question. With modern implants, we tend to think they're going to be lasting longer than the implants we had in the late 90s and early 2000s. The main data that you could probably quote would be that most knee replacements, if you did 100 knee replacements today, in 20 to 25 years, probably about 75 to 80% of those patients still have a functioning joint in place and have not had any further surgery. Certainly, you know, I tell all my patients, I'm a human being putting metal and plastic parts in you, right? As much as we do a lot of these and we do extra years of training, specifically in joint replacement and reconstruction of the joint, I'm putting a mechanical device in you. And mechanical devices, like anything else in life, can fail. It's not common. It's not a reason to not do it. And we're always refining our techniques. But I think if you had to give the average person on the street an understanding of their likelihood of success, we usually say about 75 to 80% of people at 20 to 25 years still have a functioning knee replacement in. As newer implants stay on the market longer, we will have, you know, longer term data, but the more modern implants that we think will last longer just haven't been on the market long enough to follow these patients to say whether that's going to come to fruition. But I think most people can expect a reasonable result in the long term, but there are patients who do require other procedures. That's just being transparent about it. There's no guarantees in life like anything else. I think the important thing is, you know, finding a surgeon who's well-versed in revision surgery and can take care of any mechanical issues that may occur, and be able to have the tools in their toolbox to handle issues as they come up, which is rare but possible.
Yeah, and I guess for this first part, we'll just leave it at this, that the responsibility of the patient post-surgery is to do the physical therapy and all that, but also to maintain a healthy weight, to get exercise, and to know that just because you got an artificial knee doesn't mean you could go back to bad habits that maybe helped increase your possibility that you needed the surgery in the first place.
Absolutely. Very well said. For all the times we've been together, you've been listening to what I'm telling you.
Right.
Like, because you're giving me my talking point. Exactly. But it is true. You know, we know, and it's pretty well known in orthopedic surgery, that healthier, more fit patients with a healthier weight, they just tend to have less complications. There are many factors that could lead to a bad outcome, and certainly within the surgeon's hands, there are some. There are many that are outside all of our control, but the patient does have some control. I like to tell my patients, joint replacement does not happen to you. It happens because of you. It is not a passive process. So maintaining a healthy weight, keeping your medical issues well looked after and under control, diabetes, not smoking, healthy diet, good exercise, good sleep, all of these things play into the recovery. And if you get your knee replaced and think, you know, I had it replaced and now all these things will just, all these doors will be unlocked for me, many times they are, but it's with the understanding that you put the work in. It has to happen because of you, not just passively to you. So the journey for the patient really starts getting through the surgery. And then, as we talked about, we'll kind of document this as we go, but it is some onus is on the patient to try to be healthy, certainly leading up to surgery, and then that has to continue into the after-surgical time frame as well.
Yeah, well put. All right. I think we've done a decent job of setting this up. So Next time we talk, we will do part two, and that'll be what happens post-surgery, maybe a little bit of in-surgery. I'm sure you sing to me while I'm out. And then and then where it goes from there. But I hope that helps people at least a little bit to think about where they are, what they might do, and to consider having a better life than they have now. Because as you know, Doc, you can get used to the pain. You can get used to this. Well, this is what they feel like. And then, you know, you go years that way, and then it's maybe not fixable.
Yeah, no, I hear that a lot. People come in afterwards. Usually for the first few weeks after surgery, people don't like me very much. You know, they say, look what you did to me. And I bet I try to set the stage very early on beforehand. I use the dimmer. It's like a dimmer switch raising right. up slowly. You're not going to feel immediately better. And ultimately I'm not giving you a haircut, you know, I'm replacing your joint here. And so we got to have a little bit of mental fortitude to understand that this is what we're getting ourselves into. But I think in the end, most people, if they have a reasonable expectation about what we can do for you, if you try to get yourself in the best place to have surgery, and maybe, you know, try to stay a little bit of fit and in some reasonable conditioning ahead of time, you're setting yourself up for at least a good chance at an outcome that you'll be happy with.
Dr. Charles Lupo, one of the finest orthopedists on the planet. I mean, I don't go to any hack. I go to the best.
I don't know what ranking system you're going off there, but I'll take what I can get.
And all part of the Northwestern Medicine System. What is the name of the practice?
I'm out in the west region of Northwestern. There's a couple. Northwestern is a larger grouping of several kind of regional areas. We're out in the west region. I'm primarily at Central DuPage Hospital in Winfield is where we operate. We're called the regional medical group for Northwestern Medicine. It's kind of we cover the west region, northwest areas of the city, you know, Wheaton, Glen Ellen, sure. Winfield, Warrenville, all these areas out that way. So.
All right, Doc. Well, I appreciate your time very much, and we'll do it again. Thanks for being on Live from My Office.
All right, Steve, thanks for having me, and look forward to getting you taken care of here in the future, buddy.
Today's charity that I'm plugging is the World Central Kitchen. You may already have known or certainly have seen the famous celebrity chef Jose Andres, who I think first really came to prominence with his charitable work that he does with Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Floyd. And he stepped up in a huge way. Anyway, wherever there's a problem, he steps up. And World Central Kitchen is doing great work in regards to the pressure people are under with COVID. It's a hot plate of food when and where it's needed most. And again, it's Jose Andres and his wife, Patricia, that are behind the effort. Now, the World Central Kitchen takes care of the stress on food delivery and getting food to people in all circumstances. But if you go to the website, wck.org, and click on the menu, you'll see COVID-19 food relief right there. I mean, I recommend you donate regardless, but if you want to specifically see how they help with COVID-19 food relief, click on the menu and click on that tab. But do whatever you can to help. If you're lucky enough to have a hot meal tonight, keep in mind those who need others' help to get that done. It's World Central Kitchen. The chef is Jose Andres, WCK.org. And as always, if you have a charity you'd like me to talk about or mention or plug, it's absolutely free. I'm happy to do it, and I like finding out about other organizations that I might be able to help. Drop me an email with notes on the same to thecochraneshow@gmail.com. I want to thank Dr. Lupo and Dr. Most. Again, provided my surgery doesn't get canceled for need of COVID beds, we will have Dr. Lupo back relatively soon to talk about part two, the second stage of where this goes. It's not just because I'm an exhibitionist and I want to talk about my knee surgery because I'm old. No, I want this to help you as well, and I think it can help some people. And thanks to Dr. Kevin Most as well for the catch-up, even though it's not a lot of news that brightens our day. If you go to apt.com, most fine people at Apt pleasing people since the time of Genghis Khan. There's great deals there all the time and great stuff for you. Now, they have given us a whole bunch of gift cards. And if you have won a gift card from me in the past, you haven't received it yet, catching up as fast as we can here. So thank you. And we had a big response to this. And again, I'll get them to you just as fast as I can. But I do want to say there's still a chance for you to get in on this. If you would like an app gift card, a gift from me and the folks at App to you, here's all you do. We're spreading the word about the podcast. And if you send me an email to thecochranshow@gmail.com with the names of three of your friends and their email addresses, I will send them a sample of the podcast and in turn send you the app gift card. Just make sure you include your mailing address for that. All right? thecochranshow@gmail.com. Send me your mailing address and three friends plus their emails who may like live from my office. And honestly, why wouldn't they? All right, later this week, Men of a Certain Rage, four very funny comedians, John DeCoste, Tim Banker, the great Mike Toomey, and me, later this week on Live from My Office. So again, thank you. Whether you're listening on Apple, Spotify, at CochranShow.com, subscribe, follow, rate, and review. Throw a comment in there too if you like. And we appreciate all that you do supporting Live from My Office, sponsored as always by David Hochberg and Team Hochberg, 855-56-DAVID or 56david.com. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We'll see you then on Live from My Office.
30 years plus on the airwaves, you have turned your dial to me. Now you're tuned into my podcast. It's Live from My Office, Steve. From Ithaca, New York, to Carolina South, W. Cochran Steve. From Minneapolis, and then Chicago twice, top-rated shows achieved. Sit back, relax, and now listen to my show. When or wherever you are, 'cause you're on the go. A-list celebs with some laughs and great info. Live from my office, the Steve Cochran Podcast Show.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
No better place to be.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Subscribe and like for free.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Live from my office, Steve.
So glad you're with me. It's Live from My Office, Steve.
Thank you for listening to Live from My Office, a service of Monkey Run Productions. All rights reserved. The podcast is hosted by Steve Cochran, and it's mixed, edited, and produced by me, Ross Cochran. Steve is available for corporate speaking gigs. He would love to MC your event. And occasionally, he's funny. Thank you for listening. Head to CochranShow.com for more.